directors like Fellini, Bergman, and Truffaut, and he was well known for his affairs. He'd been connected with a string of high-profile actresses like Isabella Rossellini. He was Sophie's second husband. Her first marriage only lasted a few years. She got married young and had a son, Pierre-Louis. Westcourt guards would learn all this in time, but on that first day, the local authorities weren't even sure of Sophie's full name. At first everyone had it as Sophie Bugnol. The name Toscan du Plantier didn't come out until a day or two later. It turned out that Bugnol was Sophie's maiden name, but it's the name she used in West Cork, the name she listed herself as in the phone book. She'd bought the house in West Cork after her marriage to Daniel. In fact, he paid for it. And it wasn't as though she didn't take his name, she was Toscan du Plantier in Paris. So why was she using a different name in West Cork? Those early days of the investigation seemed to have been about piecing all this together. Starting with what Sophie was doing there, by herself, so close to Christmas.
Because it's a difficult area to have a quiet relationship.
James Donovan, the head of forensics, says the guards were exploring whether Sophie had a local love interest, a difficult secret to keep in a place like West Cork.
It would be quiet insofar as there wouldn't be too much traffic around, but it wouldn't be quiet insofar as people would notice. There's very little you could do privately. You think you're private, and in fact you're being watched like a hawk by everybody.
Ian Bailey, the reporter who took us out to the crime scene, used his local contacts to peer into her love life.
On different occasions, she came over with different men, and she had she was having relationships with, if not all of them, at least one of them. It appeared that she had some sort of open marriage.
Ian wrote an article that appeared on the front page of an Irish tabloid, The Daily Star, under the headline Sophie's Tangled Love Life. He described a beautiful and glamorous French woman with society connections and a hideaway love nest in West Cork. But it wasn't just Ian. We went through early coverage of the murder and found this was a common theme. The same newspaper also quoted a French journalist as saying, Sophie was like a man in relation to her love life. She would collect lovers. She would drop them. She got bored with them. It's as though the media were looking to all this to construct some cautionary tale around her demise, like the promiscuous teen in a slasher movie. Headlines referred to Sophie as the separated mother, the divorced mother, the twice-married blonde. There was talk that clues had been found at the house, suggesting Sophie had had a visitor. Chairs pulled close together in the kitchen, two wine glasses left by the sink.
There was also talk that not only did she know her killer, but she had entertained her killer, and the evidence, quote-unquote, for that was two wine glasses in a sink. Were there two wine glasses in a sink?
I won't go into the detail of what was found in the house, because that is the subject of forensic tests and forensic examination. And
This is Chief Superintendent Noel Smith, trying to address some of the tabloid rumours in an RTE radio interview.
There was a hint in another newspaper that she might have been in bed with somebody. We have no evidence to that effect. And there was also the suggestion that this unfortunate woman had a bevy of young men in her West Cork holiday home.
There's no evidence.
All of those things to us were, as far as I'm concerned, not correct.
And there are those in West Cork who remember instinctively feeling that this picture of Sophie in the press as a vixen just didn't make sense.
If this lady had been having wild orgies or parties or whatever it was, then we'd have known. Somebody would have known and somebody would have told everybody. You know, that's, you know.
I don't know, obviously, but I certainly have saw no evidence of it here anyway.
What of her having an affair with
Granny? No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't go along with that at all.
Thing is, none of these people could say much of anything conclusively about a woman they'd known only fleetingly, if at all. To get a proper sense of Sophie, be it Bugnol or Toscan du Plantier, we needed to speak to the people who had known Sophie more than just fleetingly. Her son, brother, sister-in-law, her aunt, her uncle, her best friend. Be warned, their English is great, their accents are French. We're talking Gérard Depardieu inspecting a glass of cognac French. So you might have to lean in to listen.
I'm Pierre-Louis Baudet. I'm 34 years old. I'm French.
Pierre-Louis is Sophie's son. He was 15 when she died. Today he runs a property company with his dad.
I have two kids. I'm married.
He has two small children, a son named Louis and a daughter called Sophie.
Everything is okay.
It sounds like over the years, they as a family have got better at dealing with the media, at blocking out all the rumours that were written about his mother.
They invent, they create my mother's life.
What sort of a person was she to you?
She was my mother, and, well, when she divorced, she was very poor, and we used to live in a very small flat in Paris. And she was not an artist, but she was living for artists, an artistic manner. That's why she divorced with my father, who was a real pragmatic guy, a working guy.
Pragmatic, like down to earth. In other words, nothing like her next husband, the flashy movie producer Daniel Toscan de Plantier. Pierre-Louis was 9 when Sophie married Daniel. Daniel died of a heart attack at a film festival in 2003, so we never got to talk to him. But Lara Marlowe, the Irish Times Paris correspondent, met him a number of times after Sophie's murder. He told Lara about how Sophie was not easily won over. So he turned up outside her office one day on the Champs-Élysées.
And he said, please, I really need to see you. I want to see you. And she said, well, I don't go out with married men. And he was getting divorced. He said, write to my mother. If you can convince my mother I should see you, then I will.
So Daniel sent copies of his divorce papers to Sophie's mother, Marguerite, who then responded saying, quote, you have a bad reputation, but my daughter is free to do as she likes. It's not quite the blessing you'd hope for from your future mother-in-law, but Daniel took it. Sophie's middle brother, Bertrand, said that when Sophie first told the family she was dating a celebrity, they wondered whether it would change things between them. But when Bertrand met Daniel, he liked him.
He was a very interesting guy. When he started to speak, you cannot stop him.
Though he was certainly charming, Bertrand didn't quite see the attraction.
Not physically. Well, that's my opinion. Not for me.
You didn't have to marry him, though, you know.
Safe.
It sounds like Daniel inhabited his own world. And while Sophie embraced it, the dinners, the public events, the movie premieres, that was only part of who Sophie was.
My sister was quite different. Yes, she liked also glamour, but not all the time. She liked also to be alone or to be quiet and to be just in her mind, to write, work, to read.
She liked solitude, and that was something she just didn't have in common with her husband. When Daniel spoke about Sophie, he said that she had an obsessive sense of mystery. She liked to have lots of secret gardens. Even after we married, I'm not sure I knew everything about her. The journalist Lara Marlowe talked about interviewing Daniel after the murder and noticing that he still had a photograph of Sophie up on his wall.
It was a black and white photo that had been taken the summer before she was murdered, sort of Alice in Wonderland, long blonde hair. And she seems to be reaching into a wall of ivy. And it was, in fact, the kitchen window at their holiday home. And she was handing a plate back into the kitchen or something. Daniel loved that photograph, and I can understand why.
There seems something unattainable about Sophie. There's a video on YouTube of her, filmed in Paris on her 28th birthday. It's a close-up of her face, shot on film by an artist friend of hers. She's on a rooftop. In the background, you can see the top of St. Eustace Church, the church where Sophie was baptized and where her family held a small memorial service for her after her death. There's no sound, but you can see that it's a windy day. Sophie spends much of the time brushing her hair out of her face. When she looks at the camera, she's a little self-conscious, but happy, laughing and talking every now and then. But when she looks down or off to the side, she disappears from us completely. She's deep in thought and far away.
Daniel said she had a sort of idealistic vision of love. She wanted real, total, absolute romantic love. And I think, therefore, she was always disappointed.
You can never really know what happens in other people's relationships. And Sophie and Daniel's clearly wasn't perfect. There was Daniel's reputation for having mistresses, and during a rocky patch in their relationship, Sophie had had an affair as well. He was a French artist named Bruno Carbonet. Sophie described him to friends as having a dark, intense personality, and he had visited her West Cork house. When Sophie broke off the affair, he was devastated. Friends of Sophie told police that Bruno started sending her weird stuff through the post, cut up pieces of his own paintings, a large screw, that he hid in the hallway of her apartment building waiting for her, then pushed her up against the wall so she couldn't breathe. And there were reports, printed in the Daily Star, that Bruno had tried to strangle her at a Paris metro station. Onlookers had had to pry his hands from her throat. Bruno's past behavior makes him sound pretty suspect, and he had been to Ireland with Sophie. He'd been more than once, just not that weekend. The French police confirmed his alibi, that he was at an art auction in France on the night that Sophie was killed. Bruno said his affair with Sophie had lasted on and off for 18 months, until Christmas 1993. They tried to be discreet, but he was pretty sure that Daniel knew about it. He said Sophie didn't have a real relationship with Daniel, that it was almost a contract. Sophie was just required to turn up at events, like a marriage of convenience. But according to those closest to them, at the time of the murder, Sophie and Daniel were happy together. They were talking about having a baby. We know that one of Sophie's last telephone calls from Ireland was to the gardener at their country home in the south of France, arranging to have a tree planted outside their bedroom window as a Christmas present for Daniel. She'd spoken to him several times over that trip to West Cork, and they had plans to spend New Year's together in Africa with friends. Daniel was in their country home the night of the murder. The French consulate finally reached him there on the evening of December 23rd to tell him the news. But then he did something a lot of people would find strange. He stayed put. He didn't go to Ireland. As Sophie's parents and brother and aunt all boarded a flight to Cork on Christmas Eve, Daniel stayed behind in his country retreat. When a husband doesn't rush to the place his wife's just been murdered, it's easy to ask questions. But there isn't a checklist for how to behave when someone you love is murdered. It isn't predictable or neat and clean. We asked Sophie's brother Bertrand about it.
Some people in my family did not like, or did not appreciate, that the fact that he was not coming is exactly like danger. You don't know how you can react if you have never been confronted to that. I think that when he has received the information, he was totally out, I would say, out of order, like an elevator.
It sounds like his family weren't too impressed, but it didn't make them question him at all. They never for a moment suspected that Daniel had anything to do with Sophie's murder. The guards knew he'd been in France that night. In West Cork, you'll hear rumours that Daniel may have somehow arranged her death. But no one close to Sophie or the investigation that we spoke to gives this theory any time. Clearly, he had no difficulty breaking off relationships when he wanted to. We looked into the other men that Sophie had supposedly been spotted with at her house in West Cork over the years. They turned out to be her brother, her uncle, her husband, her father, a work colleague. So what was Sophie doing in West Cork, alone, just days before Christmas?
In 1992, Sophie began looking for a place to get away, to escape. She remembered the foreign exchanges that she and her brother Bertrand had done in Dublin as teenagers. She ended up touring the west of Ireland looking for the perfect spot, and she kept a diary as she went. She wrote, "Could I bear the solitude of a country like Ireland? I would like to live in the wild. I would like to write there, in this noisy, windy tranquility, go there out of season, settle in for the autumn and winter." They speak of the weather with great interest and concentration, constantly assuring you that the weather of the day is unusual. I have to admit that it's very cold here at the moment. I like this country. I'm adapting to it at the same time that my body is more or less getting used to the cold. I'm growing physically tougher, and I feel at ease here with these people, their language and their reflections. Ireland, the sky and the sea and the earth. Nothing else as far as the eye can see. Furrows in the ground where they have dug out and collected the peat. Autumn, where everything is red and green like the hair and the eyes of the Irish. Any description seems superficial compared to the reality of Ireland. Sophie narrowed it down to two places, in two very different landscapes. A more tranquil part of Connemara and the wilder West Cork. In her diary she wrote, "What is my preference? It is difficult to choose between gentleness and violence." In the end she chose West Cork, enchanted by a white farmhouse that looked out to the Atlantic, and on a clear day, the lighthouse perched on a perilous fastnet rock. Daniel bought Sophie the house here, but he only visited once. Unlike their fancy apartment in an expensive part of Paris, and Daniel's chateau in the countryside, Sophie's house in West Cork reflected her interests, passions, and needs for the place. It was sparsely decorated and filled with books.
It was really like a peace place.
Sophie's best friend, Agnès Thomas, visited West Cork with Sophie.
With a view on the place to relax and be quiet. She was really loving that place.
Yeah.
And for her, it was really the place to relax and to be okay with herself.
Agnès says it was too windy to sit outside. It was freezing cold. And it seemed like there was always something leaking in the house. It wasn't everyone's idea of a perfect getaway. But Bertrand says this is exactly what Sophie was looking for.
I think that she wanted a place, a wild place, with very few people, that was empty, very few things, you know. In her bedroom, it was just the bed and that's all. Very few things on the wall, very few things in the kitchen. It was exactly how you can imagine, Sophie. It was exactly that. So we find her when we enter in the house.
Maybe in this context, it makes sense that Sophie used her maiden name in West Cork. In Ireland, she didn't want to be Toscan de Plantier, wife of a celebrity. She wanted to escape all that, to reclaim who she was before she met Daniel, her simple life with Pierre-Louis.
Since Sophie's death, people have read into all sorts of things, looking for some meaning or explanation. The guard spoke to several passengers on her flight. They remembered that she was on her own. The lady who sat next to her in business class said she didn't talk to her, that Sophie had seemed quiet, reserved, but not anxious. CCTV footage from Cork Airport shows Sophie walking through arrivals on her own, pushing her trolley, on the way to the rental car desk. Guards trawled passenger lists of flights and ferries from France, but found no one of interest. We found out that Sophie had, in fact, asked several people to go with her to Ireland that weekend, but everyone she asked turned her down. Daniel had work, her friend couldn't get away, her aunt Marie-Madeleine was out with the flu, her brother Bertrand and his wife just had a baby. Daniel would later say that those who didn't go were suffering immensely for it. They'd have to wonder, what if? But no one thought it was strange or suspicious that Sophie went on alone. She'd never been to West Cork by herself before, but she wanted to take a few days off, and there were some things around the house that needed fixing. Sophie left Paris for Cork on Friday. The following Monday evening, Sophie's mother, Marguerite Bonniol, was watching the news. there was a report that the body of a French woman had been discovered in County Cork.
Le corps d'une jeune Française d'une trentaine d'années a été découvert aujourd'hui dans le comté de Cork. La victime, à demi dévêtuée, portant des blessures à la tête, était venue passer quelques jours de vacances dans une petite maison isolée. Une
autopsie. The reporter said the victim was half clothed and suffered head injuries. She'd been spending a few days on holiday in an isolated cottage. There were no more details, no town, no description of the victim, but somehow Marguerite knew it was her daughter. She called her sister, Marie-Madeleine, and told her that a woman had been killed in Cork.
Immediately I said, but Cork region is so large, so big, a woman. But she's French, but a French woman, you have some in Ireland. And after she called me, but it's not Cork, it's Skull.
Skull, the nearest town to Sophie. Bertrand tried to reach her in West Cork. He tried every number he had.
But I tried to call my sister, and I couldn't have her, and I tried to call Josephine.
He's talking about Josephine Helen, Sophie's caretaker. He says she didn't want to be the one to tell the family. So Bertrand put it simply, is my sister alive? She said no. Then someone had to tell Pierre Louis. He was spending Christmas with his father.
I was in my grandparents' countryside house. And it was in the night, and my father came to see me. And, and the rest is too intimistic. Well, you know, it's too... In 2 seconds, all your life changed.
The next day, Christmas Eve, Sophie's parents, aunt, and brother Bertrand caught the last flight to Cork. They navigated the media scrum and arrivals. The guards were waiting for them there, too.
Our first goal was to go in Sophie's house. I want to sleep in my sister's house.
The guards told them the house was a crime scene, but Bertrand still wanted to go in.
Perhaps we can see things that are different than the things that were before, and perhaps it can help someone.
The answer was still no. Instead, the family were taken to a hotel. They were put in separate rooms and, without an interpreter, hammered with questions about Sophie.
Why she came alone, what were her relationship with her husband, did she have some enemies, what was the relationship with her first husband, and everything like that. The police knew that she was the wife of Daniel Couture-Scornpontier, but they didn't know nothing about her.
Then the guards told them to stay put, and they left. Sophie's family weren't allowed to go to West Cork, but nor were they allowed to see Sophie's body, which was now in the morgue at Cork University Hospital, just a few miles from them. As they set about trying to find somewhere to get some food on Christmas Eve in Cork City, the post-mortem was well underway.
Dr. John Harbison, the pathologist, had finally arrived at the crime scene on Christmas Eve, 26 hours after Sophie's body was found, and who knew how much longer it had lain there before that. As for a time of death, Harbison could now only make an educated guess. The body temperature had long since leveled off to its surroundings, a process known as alga mortis, or the second stage of death. He found no indication of sexual assault, or of any recent sexual activity. He noted almost 50 wounds on the body. There were lacerations on the back of Sophie's hands and to the back of her head, so deep they cut through to the brain. Her lip had been torn away from her gum, suggesting she'd been punched in the face. And her skull was fractured. Harbison declared this the cause of death. He thought the slate and the concrete block found by the body were both likely weapons. But the injuries told him there must have been a third weapon, something that was missing from the scene.
Christmas Day came and went, and the following day, the guards called for Bertrand.
So I went alone with police to recognize my sister's body. It's not very an easy thing to do.
Sophie's hair had been so matted with blood that they'd cut it short. The coroner had bandaged up her hands to spare her family the distress of seeing how wounded they were. And they'd applied a thick layer of makeup.
especially because she has been hurt at the face, and the face have been remodeled by the coroner, so it was very difficult to recognize her.
In fact, it looked so unlike his sister that Bertrand didn't feel comfortable formally identifying her.
And so they asked me if my parents could come, and I bring my parents and my aunt to once again visit my sister Buddy. And it spent about 15 minutes, and after we go back. So it was a very strange day.
By the end of the week, Sophie's body would be released to the family, and Daniel would hold a large, celebrity-filled funeral back in France. Her family would hate it and think it didn't reflect Sophie at all. A few days later, they would hold another, simple and private ceremony in the Paris chapel where Sophie was baptized. At the funeral arranged by Daniel, the family were asked by the guards to be on the lookout for anyone suspicious, anyone with fresh cuts or scratches. But it seems that the guards were beginning to think that Sophie's killer hadn't come from France. On the night she died, the last person Sophie spoke to was her husband Daniel. She called him at about 10:30 p.m. He was busy with work, but he called her back half an hour later. Sophie didn't mention that she'd had anyone over in the house, or that she was expecting anyone. And it just doesn't sound like there was someone else with her. She could have been putting on a show, but it would have been a pretty convincing show. Sophie called Daniel. If she was otherwise engaged, why would she call him at all? We asked Sophie's family about the two wine glasses on the draining board and the chairs pulled close together. Did it mean that someone else had been in the house with Sophie? They didn't think so. Sophie probably used both glasses herself and just hadn't put them away. And with the chairs, that's just how Sophie liked to read, sitting on one, feet up on the other. The book of poetry on the kitchen table told them that's exactly what she'd been doing. The guards found a plastic bag from the supermarket in Skull and checked her receipts with the owner for what she'd purchased. They concluded it didn't look like Sophie was cooking for a guest. Daniel told the guards that when he called Sophie back that night, they spoke about her day and she sounded in good spirits. Daniel says she'd been teasing him about not getting back in time for Christmas, but on the call she told him she'd managed to get a flight back for Christmas Eve. So Daniel said he'd meet her at the airport. He said she sounded tired that night and was already in bed. If she had heard a noise outside after they hung up, Daniel says she was the type who would slip on her boots and go outside to investigate.
Years later, Sophie's mother came across a passage in one of Sophie's journals. She talked to the journalist Lara Marlowe about it. It was about something Sophie had seen out walking one day in West Cork.
She described a fox stalking sheep in Ireland. Let me see if I can find it. Here it is. The most haunting image is of a fox stalking the lambs. I'm quoting Sophie, "This animal that pulls me unwittingly into his clandestinity, forcing me, but also you, to remain silent, to become his companion in hunting." Later, she finds a dead sheep by the path, open quote, "A devoured cadaver with his skeleton and skin spread out a little further away. Raw wool, white and animal, dirty and smelling. In fact, the whole scalp of a body, an empty envelope mixed with dirt and blood. You die in the wind, in the sea, on the land here. The rottenness is spread out in daylight, perfectly natural." I'm not a believing person. I'm not really superstitious. As a journalist, I kind of stick to facts, but sometimes when you come across these sorts of coincidences, you wonder.
Daniel didn't speak publicly about the murder for more than a year afterwards. He said it was out of decency and modesty, and because he knew Sophie would have hated it. When he finally gave an interview to the French newspaper Le Figaro, he said he hoped that Sophie would forgive him for speaking. He talked about how difficult it had been to see the news coverage and gossip and suspicion around him in the immediate aftermath, and how his friends and family banned him from watching the news or reading the newspaper. The only thing he was allowed to watch was the weather. He talked about who might have done it, or how it might have happened. Asked whether he thought her fame or status in France, the fact that she was married to him, could have played a role, Daniel thought it must have. He said that Sophie was naive enough to believe that she was still herself, that their marriage hadn't changed anything, and that she was still a free and independent young woman, that that's what the house in Ireland was all about. But he said it wasn't that simple. You can't put up barriers between public and private life. He was sure that whoever did it knew who she was. Daniel talked about losing Sophie as an incurable wound. He said what he was struggling to deal with was it wasn't like a car accident. It wasn't fate. With Sophie's murder, there had been a will behind it. There was someone on earth who did it. He said there was a devil somewhere in the hills of Southern Ireland.
West Cork is an Audible original production, written and produced by Jennifer Ford and Sam Bungie. Produced and sound designed by Kristen Muller, Alex Trajano, Robin Wise and Paul Schneider. Our theme music was composed by Sharni Avaran. Our recording engineer is Sean Moher. West Cork is edited by Mike Olive. Our fact checker is Christine Baird. And Jesse Baker and Eric Newsom are the executive producers. Anywhere human life coexists with freezing weather and a large icy body of water, you'll find a tradition of people gathering in the dead of winter to hurl themselves into those icy depths.
This is Christmas Day, 1996. It's Dull, West Cork. John, this is John with his bottle of brandy. Fair play to John.
There are common features to the ritual. The nerve-stealing countdown. The shrieking children and the pained whooping of the men as they plunge into the freeze. And there are onlookers, bundled up in their winter coats, sipping hot whiskey, laughing and cringing as they chart the wretched path of a friend or relative through the surf. Skull has a swim every year, Christmas Day, down at the pier. Back in 1996, a young woman named Florence Newman, home for the holidays from Dublin, made this video on a big hulking camcorder.
Oh, Pat, there's a fine West Cork man, if you know.
Florence is an expert sportscaster. Even though the actual event isn't so much a swim as a melee with people wading around turning blue, it's the social event of the Christmas season.
Oh, hold on now, Dennis is giving us a flash of the nether region. And I don't know if I... Oh, Dennis, that's enough now, Dennis. This is a family program, boy.
The swim brings together people from all over. Far-flung relatives home for Christmas. People who just turn up for the spectacle. And some faces that locals don't recognize.
And where are you from, Toby?
I'm from Oklahoma in America.
Oklahoma, long way from Skull now, isn't it?
You're right, but I'm living here now.
And do you have any message for the people of Skull, huh?
That I love it here a lot.
Fair play, okay. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you as well.
Thank you.
But there was something different about the 1996 swim. This is West Cork, an Audible original series. I'm Sam Bungie.
I'm Jennifer Ford. And this is episode 4, Killer Among Us. There was a guard, Detective Kevin Kelleher, out on the Chilly Pier scanning the swimmers and onlookers for anyone, anyone, who might bear injuries from, say, wielding a concrete block, or chasing someone through briars. Injuries on their hands that might suggest they've been involved in a struggle. He noted that Florence and others were filming the event. Later, he would arrange for a copy to be made of this video, and it would become a piece of evidence in the investigation into the murder of Sophie Toscan de Plantier.
I remember being down at the pier on that Christmas day.
That's Len, the guy who traded his car for a donkey.
There was like a veil over Skull, really. It was an atmosphere.
Can't say whether the killer was a local or someone from abroad.
It was a local person who did it. That person could do it again.
That is correct.
It was no Christmas, Sam.
Tom Quinn, the house painter. He says that feeling seemed to consume the town.
There was no Christmas. We went through the motions of Christmas. We cooked the dinner, we gave out the presents, blah, 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 blah. We went through the motions of it. But at the back of our minds, we were still trying to figure out what was going down.
It wasn't much of a Christmas for scenes of crime detective Eugene Gilligan either. He'd been at the post-mortem until late on Christmas Eve and then driven home to Dublin.
And I got in at 4:45 on Christmas morning, put together a train set, big Barbie doll house, I think it was, with three daughters. Then we did food, had dinner, Christmas dinner. I fell asleep at about 3 o'clock afternoon in the chair. Everybody there. They left me alone. That was grand. Got up the next morning, 5:30 or 6 o'clock. Back to Cork.
Gilligan would spend days at the crime scene, bagging and tagging physical evidence. Experience told him that with a frenzied attack like this, forensics would help lead them to the killer.
That's what we would naturally and normally have assumed. Instinct is that I think there should be evidence available to prove a culprit was here because of the violence that it was.
He says the list of items taken from the crime scene would run to pages and pages. The bloodied slate and the concrete block from next to the body, her blue bathrobe. They even took the entire farm gate from the bottom of the drive.
The gate may have yielded a finger mark or something like that.
They would launch a search for the third weapon that had made the cuts to the back of Sophie's head and hands. And they would get a lead from Sophie's housekeeper that there was a small hatchet missing. It was usually kept by the back door and used to split firewood.
The search for the murder weapon continues also in the fields and hills around the holiday house at Tourmore, about 8 miles from Skull, where Madame Duplantier had been spending Christmas. Gradually, the search area has been widened to include mine shafts in the area, but it is tedious and difficult work.
DNA testing was just getting started, but Detective Gilligan would send samples overseas. He'd even travel to a new state-of-the-art lab in England carrying bags full of briars he'd clipped from the hedges around Sophie's body.
You're going to work in the morning in the traffic and you're going to say, no, I have to do that and I have to, someone must look at that again or, and you'll have something set up and it's there, it's always there. It's constantly inside in your head.
But it would all come to nothing. Even the tiny smear of blood they thought they found on Sophie's back door turned out to be too small to test. There would be no evidence from the blood, nail scrapings, and other samples they took from Sophie's body. The strands of hair wound around her fingers were her own. Detectives figured they'd come away in her hands as she tried to protect her head from her attacker's blows. The one interesting footprint they found close to the body was impossible to accurately cast. The liquid plaster kept seeping through the gravel.
The search of the area around the house at Tourmore has been scaled down and the murder weapon hasn't been found. Chief Superintendent Smith said this was a disappointment, but it was a very difficult area to search.
Trying to figure out how forensics came up with nothing. It's difficult to know if it had anything to do with all those delays on the first day, or whether it was just down to bad luck. Gilligan said that an outdoor scene can be difficult to preserve, but that he was happy with how the scene had been handled by the local officers. So was it possible that the person they were looking for had managed to be very careful while apparently losing their head? Years later, new DNA tests would be carried out on material from the scene, and a decade later still, Sophie's body would be exhumed for examination by French scientists. But that all came to nothing too.
It seriously disappointed all of us, but certainly me, that I went to a crime scene and it didn't matter where it was or what it was. I would walk in and say, I do my very best to get whoever has just done that. That person didn't deserve that. And somebody needs to be held responsible for that. We were deemed the experts that we would get the answer. The responsibility was our responsibility.
Detective Gilligan told us a case like Sophie's, a homicide where a suspect doesn't emerge quickly, is pretty rare. They had a murder victim they knew little about, and no steer on who they might be looking for. But they had to start trying to build a scenario.
Why? There's a lady about 100 metres from her dwelling, in night clothing, fatally assaulted.
The guards knew something had occurred to entice Sophie out of bed that night and down to the end of her driveway.
That's where Detective Dermot Dwyer came in.
Oh, yes. We are quite satisfied that she was above in the house that night on her own, spoke to her husband, and somebody knocked on her doors, and she came down, and she had her shoes at the bottom of the stairs and put her feet into them and went to the door, and everything happened from there.
Maybe Sophie opened the back door and went outside, where she was confronted by her attacker. The guards were assuming a male.
Maybe he had already grabbed the hatchet hanging there, or otherwise Sophie grabbed it and he wrestled it off her.
Maybe she tried to get back inside, but the door had locked behind her, so she ran down the hillside, but her attacker was close behind with the hatchet, hitting her on the back of the head. She made it to the bottom of the hill and ran out onto the drive.
The elastic on her pajamas was still attached to the barbed wire fence there, so maybe she tried to climb over but got caught, and her attacker pulled her back to the ground. Then he stood over her, hitting her with a piece of slate, and finally dropped the concrete block, fracturing her skull. Here's Detective Gilligan.
How fast, what the timeline would have been for that? Could have been seconds. It's amazing the damage can be done to a human body in seconds, if it's violent enough. The red mist, and it just comes down. It's like a veil comes in.
Gilligan has plenty of experience of arriving at a crime scene and witnessing the damage done by people who have been taken over by what he calls the red mist.
The brain gets into a vicious cycle, and literally there's no reasoning outside of doing what you're doing. And a lot of times they'll have no recollection because the brain has literally firestormed into this violence. That's why victims could be stabbed 50 times. If the perpetrator can't have what they think they're entitled to have. It could be sex, it could be drugs, it could be a debt, it could be anything. And they see only one way out of this. Now, did he entice her down? Did he try to have sex with her? Or whatever? And she said, listen, good luck and thanks. And he could start off simply with a push. Push her to the ground. If she fought, then he'd start fighting back, and then it gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. That's the normal procedure for violent crime.
At Bantry Garda Station, a team of 60 detectives has been assembled, including officers from Dublin and Cork City, who joined those from the West Cork region.
Everything that happens in the course of an investigation must be channeled through that room.
Detective Dwyer spent a lot of time in the incident room in those first few days.
Every evening, there's a conference. And everything that happens during the day and any new information, everything is discussed openly. And honestly, there's no such thing as keeping some things back. Everything is open.
Detective Dwyer explained that there was a central casebook for the murder investigation, with all photography, mapping and forensics. Everything goes in that book. A memo of a phone call or an interview is jotted onto a form called a flyer and put in the book. Witness statements are sent to a typing pool and indexed. They go in the book. The detectives assumed whoever wielded this 20-kilo concrete block was a big guy, and probably prone to rage. So the type of guy who might stand out.
You're dealing here with not an ordinary individual. We were looking for somebody that was regarded as a peculiar guy.
They also figured the killer had local knowledge.
A stranger would not find it. I could go so far as to say that if I rang a policeman in Bantry, which is about 15 miles away or something like that, and told him to go out there, he'd have a problem finding it. Your own common sense would tell you that whoever did it had to know the locality. I thought that was an advantage.
They narrowed their search for the killer to a particular part of West Cork, the Mizzen Peninsula, the isolated stretch of land with Skull and Crookhaven and a few other towns. They put out public appeals for information.
Gardaí said they want to hear from anyone who may have noticed a person with suspicious wounds or cuts or with stained or marked clothing. While they want to solve the murder quickly, Gardaí acknowledged that because of the lack of information locally in Skull about the dead woman, it could be a long and difficult investigation. They're asking for the public to phone the incident room with any information.
On Christmas Day, they got a call from a local shopkeeper, Marie Farrell. She called to say she recognised the dead woman, that Sophie had been in her shop that past Saturday afternoon. At the same time, Marie noticed a strange-looking man standing across the street from the shop. Marie described this man as slim, medium height, tanned with short hair, wearing a long black coat down to his ankles, and what looked like a French beret. The following morning, Sunday morning, she drove past the same guy, hitchhiking on the side of the road. Marie didn't stop. It struck her as odd because she'd been in town for a year now, and she'd never seen this man before. Reports came in of other odd sightings.
And information from the public in Skull Village has reported a number of cars being spotted in the Tullamore area around the weekend before the murder was discovered.
Suddenly West Cork was a staging ground for a manhunt.
We were plagued then with detectives and camera crews and Jesus. It was nightmarish.
Doors were being knocked on. People who you knew were being questioned. The 6 o'clock news showed reporters standing in the middle of town. It became claustrophobic, particularly for people in Skull, like Len Liptick.
This was enormous for the community. People going through their own thoughts, wondering, obviously, why it happened and who did it, and could it be somebody living next door to you or down the road or anywhere?
He says it was at this point people started questioning,
first of all, the red car,
just how well they knew one another.
Favorite guard.
You to have that person as a neighbor, as a friend.
Who is it? Is it somebody I know?
I started looking at different people in different ways. You know, in ways that I'd never even have any reason to look at them in that way before, you know? Your mind starts going off into all sorts of directions, you know, about various people.
And do you think, looking back on it now, do you think that it was something about that, the atmosphere at the time, that maybe you were...
Oh, it's definitely the atmosphere. I mean, everybody wanted to know who did it. Everybody wanted it resolved. Everybody wanted it finalized. Everybody wanted to know it was dealt with. End of story. Out of everybody's life.
Len even went to the guards. Not about a stranger, but about someone he knew. A single guy living with his mother, right near Sophie's house. Len had no proof, no evidence, and no reason to believe this guy even knew Sophie. Today he's embarrassed to have ever doubted him.
It's terrible. I felt really guilty. Now I feel really guilty of ever having these thoughts, you know? When you've had a thought, you've had a thought.
The guards ran down Len's thought, because Detective Dwyer says they were almost totally reliant on this kind of lead.
In our case, it's like every other murder case, it started on a very broad way, and little bits of information then start coming in about different people in the locality, unusual people, and there were about 40 or 50 suspects. But I suppose some of them, the threshold to make them suspects would be very low.
When Dwyer says 40 or 50 suspects, he's not exaggerating. Another detective would later say that at the height of the investigation, the guards had amassed no fewer than 53 suspects. It might sound like a crazy way to run an investigation, but they had to look at everyone.
For example, we demand that went out every night at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning and he'd be knocking off tins of gas and some other fellow could be stealing eggs and there's a lot of odd people in the locality. And eccentric, I suppose, would be another word for them. And you see, to other people, they're funny people, they're dangerous, they're suspect people, and all of them come in, and as a result, they have to be eliminated. It's a kind of a slow process.
Answers were going to have to come from people in the community. People like Len, spotting strange-looking people in strange places. And in rural areas, guards can generally rely on community networks, everyone knowing everyone, large families going back generations that can vouch for each other, or tell you who stole the Wellington boots from the general store, or who has a drinking problem, or who beats his wife. But West Cork was also filled with blow-ins that this old community network didn't know much about. The guards contacted Interpol for a list of foreigners in West Cork with criminal records. In return, they received a dossier of thieves, drug dealers, and sex offenders. The finding made national headlines. The Daily Mirror declared international criminals infiltrate Ireland. One guard, speaking anonymously, told a newspaper the force was a bit surprised that some of these people were here without anybody knowing their backgrounds. And there was no shortage of places for someone to hide out. The guards searched 300 vacant holiday homes and abandoned farmhouses in the wild terrain of the Mizzen Peninsula.
You're saying somebody's shielding somebody? Somebody's hiding somebody?
Well, we might call it shielding, but to the person who has the information, they mightn't see it as hard as that. But the message I want to get across to anybody who has information is that, in fact, they are shielding somebody.
Are you
who is capable, who knows who... If somebody committed a crime of this atrocity, well, then the tendency is in them to do the same thing again.
It's like reality hit you. The city hit you. Smack. People had to start worrying about things that they'd never had to worry about before.
Peter Leckie noticed people's habits started to change.
You saw a fella walking down the road, you know, do you want a lift? That's what people did. And that stopped. Because now all of a sudden it's a dangerous thing to do. And you've got to be careful where you go, who you speak to. So everybody shut their doors, didn't they? You only sort of dealt with people you knew, that you knew very well. You know, a way of life had to change.
For some, the change was an opportunity. Like Ian Bailey, the local reporter who took us out to the crime scene.
I had newspapers contacting me, French magazines were contacting me, BBC and various organs, and I was supplying them with information. And it was clearly a big story for West Cork, and I just happened to be I just happened to be here.
One of Ian's scoops came from a local couple who told him Sophie had been frightened by something during her cliff walk hours before her murder. He wrote in the Sunday Tribune, "Murdered French filmmaker Sophie Toscan du Plantier experienced a deep sense of unexplained dread only hours before her brutal slaying." Ian picked up scraps about the guards' investigation.
I knew a lot of people were getting visits, and I was talking to people who were getting visits, and now I was saying, well, what are they doing? And I knew that certain people had their fingerprints taken and hair samples.
The guards were speaking to people who had business down that way, people who knew the road, and that Sophie was at the end of it.
You know, I worked on her house.
Tom Quinn told the guards he'd never met Sophie, but he had done some painting at her house that summer.
I said, I'll tell you exactly where I was in the house. I done work on the outside, but I had to go into the kitchen. But this was 6 months prior. I said, if my fingerprints are there, they will be in the kitchen. You know, they won't be anywhere else.
The guards returned to Tom. They wanted to know, was he sure he'd never met Sophie?
And all of a sudden I was doubting myself. Did I? You know, did I actually meet her? I'm not sure. You know, maybe I did. Jesus Christ, maybe they've got a picture of me talking to her and I don't even know who she is, you know. And you begin to doubt yourself and all of a sudden I felt kind of completely vulnerable.
Then there was Leo and Sally Bolger. Leo was a local handyman and had done carpentry work on Sophie's house. His partner Sally kept horses nearby.
I mean, we never had any objection, for sure, to, you know, being ruled out. You know, that's what you hope you're heading towards, that you're being ruled out of the investigation.
But the guards didn't seem to be ruling them out. Instead, the pressure kept building. The guards separated them to cross-check their stories. They took fingerprints and hair samples.
It got to the point where I rang a solicitor, or I rang my solicitor to actually, you know, prepare him that I might be actually ringing him from the barracks one time. You know, that's how it started to feel.
Did they ever to kind of give you an idea of why they thought you might have motive to...
Well, someone told them that we wanted her house and her land. You know, we had just sold the place we were in. We wanted to move on to a bigger farm. So it wasn't a huge leap to think that maybe we'd murder her for her house and her 13 acres of land that she has there or had there, you know.
You can imagine the detectives tossing the scenario back and forth. So the two blow-ins want the land from the third blow-in. The Frenchwoman's using the place just a few times a year, and maybe the other two resent that. He works on the house, gets to liking it. The woman, Sally, keeps her horses up there, and she's thinking about starting a pony training center. This place could be perfect. So they make Sophie an offer. She turns them down. Things go south. And so they take matters into their own hands.
So, yeah, that was floated at some stage. It's a suggestion as to why we might have done it.
Which, for the record, you didn't.
No.
No.
No, it's easier by a place. Yeah.
Was it possible Sophie was killed over a property feud? Well, the guards did learn that Sophie's laneway was a hotbed of neighborhood disputes. They heard about all kinds of grievances, like the one Sophie's neighbor Shirley had against the local farmer Finbar for letting goats loose on their property, which then ate through her vegetable patch. Or when Shirley's cat got into Sophie's house and hid in the chimney and then walked her sooty paws all over the furniture. But if the guards were sifting through this looking for grounds for a murderous feud, there wasn't a lot to go on. Who knows how much weight the guards were really giving this information. For a room full of detectives investigating a crime with no hard evidence, no apparent motive, maybe one theory is as good as the next. But were these leads being pursued by the entire department? Or were factions or individual detectives pursuing their own pet theories? And who was feeding the guards these ideas? Sally and Leo even heard the guards were chasing down a theory that Sophie was caught up in the drug scene. A mule running West Corkweed back to Paris a couple of times a year. They think people in the community were using the opportunity to settle scores and take a dig at people they just didn't like. That's what Sally thinks happened to them.
That was difficult for them. And all they're going on is gossip. People's thoughts on blow-ins and stuff. Yeah.
A guard with a pen and a paper sitting in front of you, it was your time to shine, you know.
To vent it.
Yeah. And that put them on the wrong trail for quite a while. You know, when something like that happens, it's time for all the messing to stop, you know. Then you think people will pull their heads in and actually tell the truth and be serious. But it doesn't seem to work like that, you know.
On January 11th, day 20 of the investigation, the guards had a breakthrough. A call came in to Bandon Garda Station. The nervous-sounding woman on the line wouldn't say where she was calling from and didn't want to use her real name. She said to just call her Fiona. She said she had driven past a man walking along the coast road between 3 and 4 a.m. the night Sophie was murdered. She was crossing a little humpback bridge known locally as Kilfada Bridge, right by the turn off towards Sophie's place.
I just picked up this man in the headlights of my car, staggering along the road. He just appeared to be drunk. He was staggering and sort of waving his hands around.
Fiona said the man was wearing a long black coat and some kind of hat. He was stumbling along, holding his hands by the sides of his head and wiping them down his clothing. The woman hung up, saying she'd call back, but without